This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Heitor Villa-Lobos is regarded as perhaps the most famous classical composer of South America. Villa-Lobos drew his influence from the folk music of his native Brazil and traditional European style, and the result is often like this. Nearly 50 years after his death, the music of Heitor Villa-Lobos is getting a royal reawakening from one of the kings of jazz. Saxophonist and Durham resident Branford Marsalis currently paying homage to the Brazilian virtuoso with a new musical tour. Marsalis Brasilianos is a series of works honoring the legacy of classical music in Brazil and some of its most influential contributors. Branford Marsalis is my guest this hour on the program. He's here to tell us more about reinventing these classical compositions and what else he's been up to since the last time he's been on The State of Things. Far too long. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be back.
Good to have you here. Tell us a little more about Heitor Villa-Lobos. How did a Brazilian musician come to compose classical music, and what was his and how did the traditional music play into that?
Well, I think it's one of the interesting dynamics I guess for lack of a better term, the New World. Is that the New World was colonized by the Old World, and we have all world influences that we see, some that we don't even pay attention to, like something like hundreds of thousands of different types of flora, if not millions, were just eviscerated when the European grasses were brought in and the flowers were brought in. And there are American composers who compose in classical music, and Brazilian composers and Chilean composers. And Heitor was just one of the better ones. He was one of the better ones, and he made a decision. I think that there was always this, because you find it also in jazz, particularly from the early 20th century, to even the mid 20th century. There's this unhealthy obsession with newness and originality and individuality, and how do I differentiate myself? As though this is something that you can control or manufacture, and it really isn't. But I think that one of the things that Heitor decided to do is say, well, I can be unique by incorporating elements of the traditional musics of Brazil, along with my very large understanding of the European vocabulary.
What that suggests is certainly that there was an audience for European music in Brazil when he was writing, and also an audience for folk music. So those two worlds existed. What happened? Was he able to develop an audience for his music?
Well, I think that because he was one of the few that got any kind of international recognition in a country like Brazil, to get recognition in Europe was very significant, particularly in the early 20th century. Mm. And folk music has always been more popular than classical music, even in Europe. I mean, that hasn't changed. That dynamic hasn't changed to this day. But it was just his love of life, and along with his partner, his comrade, Darius Milhaud from France, who was one of these musicians who traveled to New York and spent time hanging in a jazz club. And whereas other composers would make the mistake of trying to meticulously recreate jazz rhythm, he focused on jazz sound and wrote a piece called La Création du Monde, which was a masterpiece. It's a marvelous chamber piece in terms of sonic sound. It sounds the way a traditional New Orleans band, which was very popular in the 20s at that time, it sounds the way they would sound, not necessarily in rhythm, but in tone, in tone quality. And I think that Villa-Lobos' ability to incorporate those elements and make them work was something that endeared him to Brazilians.
Well, tell us a little bit more about folk music in Brazil, because that in itself was a fusion and a hybrid.
Yeah, well, I mean, all American musics, South American musics, they all have a combination of three things: the indigenous sounds of the people who were there, the European sounds, and the African sounds. And the most amazing thing about the African contingent is that it seems like It was so sensitive to environment that wherever it went, the music changed. Because you're basically talking about a group of people who came from the same general area, Western Africa. But you bring them to America and you get jazz and blues. You bring them to Puerto Rico, you get soca, and Dominican Republic, you get merengue. You know, Puerto Rico, you get salsa, Afro-Cuban music and song tradition. You get all these different sounds. In the French Caribbean, you get zouk. So it's amazing when you, in Brazil, you get the early forms of samba. Then there's like a traditional Brazilian sound that's percussion heavy. And then there's the bossa nova, where the rhythm is more implied. It's implied in the melody, and it's implied in the way the chords are played. It's not so overtly rhythmic. It's samba.
You don't need the percussion to make it to make you know what the rhythm is.
Well, it's muted. There is percussion, but it's not in samba. The music is driven by the drums. It's driven by the beat, and they have great melodies on the top. But it's that, you know, but in samba, in bossa nova, for instance, the guitar plays the melody. So instead of playing a regular guitar play, we'd be like a ting 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 ting, and the piano would come in, and the drummer had a part, but it was usually muted, played with brushes. It was not played so stick heavy and stick oriented. So in bossa nova, the idea of rhythm was still incorporated, but it changed. It transmogrified into something a lot more subtle, but still necessary. You have to have an understanding of rhythm to play bossa nova well. And when you don't, is when you hear those bands and they always play every song going tick, 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 because they don't really understand the subtlety of it.
Right. They've got to do it with the melodic instruments as well. Well, let's hear what happens when that Brazilian folk music is fused with European classical music in a recording that you did of Heitor Villa-Lobos, one of his pieces, in 1990. This is Baquianas Brasileiras, or something like that.
Brasileiras.
Yeah, thank you. What was it that originally drew you to this music?
Melody. When I was approached to do that record, it was 25 years ago, and the producer heard me, the executive producer of Sony Classical, which was then called CBS Masterworks, was working with Winton, with my brother, and he was doing these great classical records, and she heard me play the soprano and say, "Man, you play that so beautifully. Have you ever thought about doing a classical record?" I said, "Well, no, because I can't, because I don't really have the kind of technique. I don't have the technical mastery that's required to actually play one." And she said, "Well, what about a melodies record?" I said, "Well, I can kill a whole note, so yeah, I can do a melodies record. That I can do." So I was listening to all this music that I wasn't exposed to before, saying, pick the songs you like. And I always gravitate toward the songs with the strongest melodic content.
Well, how would that differ? You talked about the need for some kind of other technical virtuosity than you believe you had in a straight, say, classical piece. But there are melodies in that. So for the untrained like me, I'm thinking a melody's a melody. What's different?
No, if you heard them juxtaposed to one another, you'd know the difference. For instance, that piece, he has several Baquianas Brasileiras he loved Bach, and it is his tribute to Bach fused with melodies from his homeland. And in this particular one, the original was for soprano voice and eight cellos. So in order to have a sound that blends with eight cellos, you have to be able to develop a tone that can be very, very delicate and very gentle.
Now, you did this, as you said, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
How is your approach to this? Has it changed at all?
Oh, completely, because I can play delicately now. Back then, I could just play, Western popular music, including jazz. Everybody just plays loud all the time. So there's never a requirement to play soft. And in that situation, because the orchestra was so big and the arrangement wasn't... they weren't really trying to play the arrangement with the original intent in mind. it kind of masks my ability, my lack of ability. It masks my lack of ability in that realm.
So then does that affect your jazz playing once you learn that technique and can master loud soft?
No, because you never forget how to play loud. So yeah. No, I mean, I can, but what it has done for the entire group is we play with a lot more dynamic range than we used to. The early records were just loud, and you can hear it. And then now, even in the loud songs, sometimes we'll make dynamic shifts. You know, for people who don't know music talk, I just mean dynamics is basically the range between soft and loud.
Yeah.
We incorporate a lot of soft elements in even the loudest songs now.
Because, but that can bring a lot more emotion. I mean, that the piano, the original forte piano, loud soft, right, was invented just to bring more passion and
Well, it brings more variety because even the most passionate musician, unidimension brings a certain level of monotony that people in pop culture would call consistency because it all sounds the same, which I just call mind-numbing repetition. Yeah. And it really opened the door to us in ways that we could make our music more interesting for people who weren't specifically jazz fans.
I'm talking this hour with Branford Marsalis, his latest foray into Brazilian music. Marsalis will take the stage tonight at Duke's Page Auditorium with the Philharmonia Brasileira. We're going to find out more about Marsalis Brasilianos as our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, saxophonist Branford Marsalis. He's won 3 Grammys. He was Jay Leno's first band leader on The Tonight Show. And rather than rest on his name and reputation, he continues to explore new outlets for his talent. Around here, Branford is a neighbor and a mentor to the next generation of musicians in his adopted home of Durham, North Carolina. His latest undertaking is an innovative exploration of Brazilian folk and classical music. The show, Marsalis Brasilianos, pays homage to Heitor Villa-Lobos, South America's most well-known classical composer, and you mentioned earlier a connection to Villa-Lobos and a French artist named Darius Milhaud. Now tell us about Darius Milhaud.
Darius Milhaud was one of the original composers. In France, they had Les Six. There was 6 great composers. You know, I probably can't remember them now, so I won't.
Darius Milhaud was at least
Darius Milhaud was one of the 6. And I think Eric Satie, Debussy, Ravel, would it have been Dubois, Max Dubois? I'm not sure. But he was one of the 6. And he really traveled around the world incorporating different elements of other cultures in the sound of his music. He was a cultural attaché to the French ambassador to Brazil and spent a lot of time in São Paulo and met Heitor there. And they spent a lot of time together. And then after that experience, he went back to Paris and Villa-Lobos met him in Paris and they hung out in expressed their love for Stravinsky and got a chance to hear all these beautiful things. And after a while, you know, Villa-Lobos went home and brought those elements and those sounds into his music.
That's interesting because that's at a time, a time of turbulence and change for music itself. So to think of these cultures coming together at a time when music is moving away from melody in a sense and moving more to tone is fascinating.
Right.
And Milhaud spent time in Harlem as well. And you talked about that, his connection with jazz.
Yeah, he heard a jazz band first in London and said, well, you know, I need to go to the source. So he went to New York and heard a band in the 20s. And at that time, the sound would have been more like the way Louis Armstrong's bands played, really rooted in the New Orleans style.
And you said that he did something interesting. Rather than try to recreate the rhythms of jazz, he tried to create the tone. And that's what he captured. Now, was anybody in the classical world paying attention to jazz at the time, or was he?
A lot of people were paying attention. A lot of people were paying attention, but they weren't sure how to approach it, because it's the approach. If you can find a lot of compositions where jazz suddenly pops in, quote unquote jazz, and it's in the variation of the dotted 16th and the 32nd note. So all the red, whenever they would have the jazz part, it would go, dun da dun da dun da 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 da, and it was interesting that Milhaud intuitively saw the problem with it and the lack of success that that ensued, or not financial success, but musical success.
And would that have been, you just noticed that you're just jamming in, you're shoehorning in something completely different. It's not textured and it's not.
Well, they're
part
trying.
Of the theme.
It just comes off corny,
yeah,
because it doesn't sound like jazz. Yeah. So his solution was, let's avoid the rhythm and let's focus on the sound. And there's the Création du Monde is one of these pieces where the alto saxophone takes the place of the viola, and it's a chamber group, about 12 musicians. And he has a lot of American rhythms, like the one he heard in the old vaudeville shows. Like at the end of the thing, they play "And Many More," which everybody knows from the Bugs
right.
Bunny cartoons. Da 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 da. And he incorporated that in a lot of them. But in the setting, you don't even hear it as that, because it's not sitting on a dominant seventh chord going really loud with a cymbal going shh at the end.
Right.
So the first time I heard the piece, I didn't even hear it. You know, and he just found a way to take all of these melodies and put them together at the end of the piece where it's like one big jam session and everybody's going on their own playing, but it works.
And
it's really
composed.
Impressive.
Well, we have a little bit of this, and in fact, this is a composition of Darius Milhaud, La Création du Monde, and but this is you in this performance. Let's listen. Branford Marsalis playing a bit of La Création du Monde, the composition of Darius Milhaud, M-I-L-H-A-U-D, if you're looking it up on the internet. And tell us about that performance. When did you do that? Who were you working with?
I was working with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. It was about 10 years ago, and it's really not a very good performance on my part.
What's wrong with it?
I was still didn't know how to play anything but loud, because I didn't really have the setup and the understanding of the music as well. It wasn't until a couple of years after I played that piece, I worked with a string quartet, four musicians, but they only worked together in the summer because they played with other orchestras, and some of them freelance. And every summer they'd get together and they'd work as a string quartet, and there was a piece by Adolf Busch, B-U-S-C-H, German expat, who lived in the States up in the Marlborough region and was prominent composer with Tanglewood. And at the first rehearsal, I heard the piece, I learned the piece, and at the first rehearsal, they ran through the piece, and then they turned to each other and they said, well, who has the melody and where? And in my mind, I'm going, well, what do you mean? It's for saxophone and strings. I have the melody all the time. And then as they started to explain it and I picked up the score, I realized I don't have the melody most times. And then it was like a complete... It's completely the opposite of the way that we think in jazz terms or in popular American terms. The lead instrument has the melody all the time.
Right.
But in this situation, the melody is passed from instrument to instrument at various points of the piece. And that was something I was not cognizant of when we did that piece. So the saxophone is kind of extremely overbearing in a lot of places where it should be out of the way.
And to get out of the way, that's when you have to learn to play soft, kind of almost fade yourself out as a cello might come in, pick it up and go.
Well, you can, and I could have played soft then, but it would have been more of a technique that we use in jazz circles called subtoning, where the sound is softer because you kind of mute it using a lowering of the jaw. Mm-hmm. And it's an airier sound. It has a lot more air in the tone when you do it, and it is softer, but it's not the same as taking the same setup and playing very loud and then playing very soft.
A whole new technique. So now tonight you're playing with the full orchestra, the Filharmonia Brasileira.
It's a smaller chamber orchestra than the Orpheus is, though.
And how does that change things for you, does it?
Well, it's more in line. We are basically playing the piece not only in the original orchestration, but the conductor, Gilles Jardim, is a Villa-Lobos scholar, and in his research he found the stage setting as it was designed by Milhaud, where every musician should sit, and we're following faithfully the original stage plot. So,
of course, that could change from place to place. I mean, if you plotted musicians on a stage, that might have a lot to do with the room itself, right? No?
Well, yeah, but still, we're going to stay true to the stage plot. You don't just kind of like move the drum set around. It's too complicated to start moving stuff around. You can move chairs a lot easier than you can move instruments and musicians.
You were talking about something very interesting that I found interesting, and that is the ability. You're taking this on tour, so you're playing several performances, and what you get to learn over the course of that time versus, say, a guest shot with a Philharmonic orchestra is fascinating. Tell us more about that.
Well, you have instant analysis oftentimes when you play with a soloist with an orchestra, you get three shots at it, and in those three shots, you say, "Well, I think I did this wrong. I need to work on this. I need to work on this," and then I start playing jazz again. I'm playing other things. I'm not playing at all. I'm practicing at home, and it would never occur to me that it could be something as simple as a change of the size of the mouthpiece or the size of the reed. It just wouldn't come up. It would never occur to me, and because I was playing three nights, four nights, five nights in a row. And I was practicing as well, you start eliminating, well, it's not practice because I'm practicing and I play it well here. But in this situation, it sounds great off stage, but it sounds bad on stage. And then the next concert, you say, well, it sounds bad because I'm trying to play softer than the instrument can actually play. So what's the solution? And it could be reed or mouthpiece. You go with the easier thing. Let's go with the mouthpiece first and keep everything else intact. And as soon as I got the new mouthpiece, the conductor says, "Man, it's blending great today. What'd you do?" And I went, "Wow." You know, and it was because I had the opportunity to play the same show five, six, seven, eight times in a row.
But that speaks to something about, because a lot of musicians will sort of make these forays into other music. They'll come out with one CD and then kind of move on. And that's always interesting to push it. But what I hear you saying is, no, you're getting into this. You have to get in and get in deep and stay with it for a while.
Well, you know, people like to talk about my eclecticism as though it is like an ID badge or something, you know, and that's not why I do this stuff. The reason I do it is because it makes me better. I'm in situations where I have to think about what I'm doing in ways that I hadn't thought before. I have to play in situations that I hadn't thought of before. And when I go back to playing jazz, I'm armed with more information that I didn't have before, and it makes all my music better all around. It makes my saxophone playing better all around. We were talking about jazz musicians, because, you know, a lot of jazz musicians play very fast. They're very fluid on the instrument. And Winton said, "Now that guy, see, he has great personal technique." And I said, "Well, man, technique is technique." He says, "No, it's not." He says, "He has great personal technique. He's practiced in a way that he can play these songs and play them very fast and very fluently. But if he was in a situation where he had to play in an orchestra or he had to play in a Broadway band, he would struggle because his technique is not universal enough. If he was forced to play softer and play that same stuff at a softer pitch, he would struggle."
But somebody could earn a reputation on that, sell a lot of records, and that could be the
end. Or not sell a lot of records, just kind of put it in the resume to help them say, "Yeah, well, I've done everything. I've played with a rock band. I play with a yeah. That's not why I've done any of that. It's not a matter I don't even talk about it, really. I don't think it has any relevance other than how you're perceived by other people. So people who like rock and roll above all other things like you, like would like me better than they like my brother because I played with Sting and went and didn't. But for me, it's all about having musical experiences that make you better in the end.
And it has. You've earned a reputation. Does it make it easier to do that, to explore these other areas and take the time, quite honestly, because you have a reputation, one that you've earned, but now you can, you know, people will give you a break. They're going to listen to your CD when you.
Will, some won't. Yeah. Some will, some won't. I mean, that's not the purpose. You know, it's vulnerable to put yourself in that situation, and it's a different way of thinking. One of the things that I was able to do in playing with the same orchestra, by the time we got to the 15th show, I'd kind of conquered my nervousness that I get when I'm in these situations, and that's what I needed to do. Is instead of playing, a three-nighter every 6 months, I needed to play a pile of shows in a row.
Do you like getting nervous? Do you like that feeling all over again?
No, I don't, but I accept it.
Yeah.
I accept it that it's part of the process. I like a little more being in control because you have so many variables going on here. Like when you're playing some of these pieces, it's easier to miss a couple of notes. And you miss those couple of notes, and then they bleed into another couple of notes, and the next thing you know, you're basically a snowball rolling downhill in a negative way. And in other situations musically that I've been in, it's been a long time since jazz was able to do that to me, and popular music was never able to do that to me. You're never really on that slippery slope, because from a musical standpoint, it's not a very difficult music to play.
Well, that's what, and so for a guy who, if you're telling me the truth here and you sort of don't like to get scared, you'd stay right there and wouldn't go off into these areas that...
Yeah, well, I accept that not only being scared, but failure is an essential part of the process. I accept that. I don't like it, but I don't get the kind of nerves, and never have gotten the kind of nerves where one would be, you know, standing over a trash can vomiting before a show. When I was playing...
Sometimes, in the case of some musicians, that's not nerves. That's just what they've been drinking.
What is that, too? There's that, too.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's, but they usually get up from the can with a smile on their face, you know? You know, but when I was playing with Orpheus, one of the flute players said, you know, how do you overcome your nerves? I said, I don't. She goes, yeah, but you're playing this music, and I get so nervous when I play that I vomit when I'm a soloist. And I said, well, I know that I'm not musically ready to play this, but I'm in this situation, and I'm going to get the most I can out of it. And if I needed to benefit from more practice, it's a little too late now since we're here, and I'm about to go mess up this music again tonight, and I just got to suck it up and bear with it. I got to grin and bear it.
And it sounds like you learn from your mistakes. I mean, you almost get excited about that. What could I take away from that?
Yeah, it's some ways. Sometimes that's the only way to really learn, because we have all these self defense mechanisms where it's more convenient to blame other people for our foibles. But the great thing about being on a stage in a classical setting is that you're out there and it's you messing it up, and there is no one to blame. It's kind of like playing golf.
Can't you blame the cellist or something? I
mean, no chance. No. You're out there in front, messing up in front of everybody. You know, it's just a beautiful thing. It's like, you know, in golf, when you hit a ball and slice it into the woods, I mean, you can't blame the cameraman. We don't have any cameramen out there. It's just you sucking. You know what I mean? It's just, and that's the, and, you know, people try to blame the club, and they try to blame, oh, I don't ordinarily play like this. You just hear all the excuses rather than just saying, man, I stink. You know, and kind of, where do we go from that point? Yeah. I play bad. Where do we go from that point?
So you're here in North Carolina. You've been here a while. And we're still counting the votes. Let me ask you about this election. How do you feel?
It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. I really like the idea that I got the sense that for the first time in a long time that the American public was actually tuned into the information, that they weren't falling for TV show rhetoric. You know, like, you know, he's a socialist, or, you know, the same policies as George Bush, all that kind of stuff that used to work in the old days. You know, he's an intellectual. Boo. That narrative didn't really wash across the board. I mean, people, like, so many things have happened in our country in the last 12 years, you know, 8 years to be specific, but also the last 12, that people are like, maybe we need to pay attention. Maybe we need to sit down and really pay attention to what's going on. I mean, news ratings were sky high, and that was great to see people engaged. And my only hope is that they continue to be engaged, and that they don't stop watching the news. I don't say you have to watch it as much as people have obsessively done it, but, you know, like, split time between sitcoms and news now. Don't just lean on the sitcoms. As Richard Dreyfuss marvelously said a couple of years ago on Bill Maher's show, he said that American citizens have abandoned their responsibilities as citizens in a republic. And when you inure yourself with rubbish, with TV shows and cartoons, and there's a crisis, you turn to the first strong man and say, tell me what to do and I'll do it. And it was just one of those brilliant things. I was sitting there watching, and he said it, and I went, whoa! Republic, that's right, we are a republic. And it just kind of changed the way. And I started telling all my friends and telling my students and people, said, we are citizens in a republic, and we have obligation. We have the obligation to question the authority when they say things, to make them justify what they say, and not to take sides against or for just based on some ridiculous ideology.
Isn't it amazing, though, that in an election where we could have had one very large distraction that would have taken us away from all the issues, that just never seemed to play a part, and that the issues, as you said, we were paying attention, both in comedy, I think, in satire, and in the news.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, especially with the stuff with between Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. I mean, it started about 5 years ago. If you really wanted to get information, you just, you know, once you push through the cynicism, the raw data is right there for you to see. I mean, they would use quotes from actual quotes from people, and they would use the quotes that the news would— the regular news, for whatever reason, chose not to use the quotes that they would find.
But how do you think we stayed focused when we could have been so easily distracted?
The stakes were too high. The stakes were just too high this time. People's 401ks were blowing up. People that a lot of Americans travel, even though most Americans don't travel. And I think that a lot of people were dismayed by how Europe perceives us. And I think that a lot of businessmen realize that they now realize that the concept of a world economy is like, great, now we get to tell the world what to do. It's like, I think a lot of people did think that. Like, we can sell our goods, but now they're seeing the results of the backlash. I mean, you know, there are countries that used to buy American Treasury bonds that are buying euros.
Yeah, well,
you're doing all sorts of things, and now we realize how important it is for us to get, you know, our stature back internationally, because it affects us monetarily.
We are very happy that you traveled internationally and have brought us Marcellus Brasilianos, which you can see tonight. Branford Marcellus, my guest, takes the stage tonight with the Philharmonia Brasileira. That's at Page Auditorium on the campus of Duke University. That'll be at 8 o'clock. You can go to dukeperformances.duke.edu for more information. Branford, always a pleasure.
Always
Thank
a pleasure,
you so
Frank.
Much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the story of race relations in Oxford comes to life. Tim Tyson's memoir, Blood Done Signed My Name, makes its stage debut. Stay tuned to The State of Things.